Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Software is eating the world, or so we're told. Products that once took up physical space can be contained in our smartphones and held in the palms of our hands. Instead of having a record collection, we can now stream any music anywhere and anytime we want. Instead of shelves and shelves of books, we can have access to thousands of volumes in our Kindle app. And instead of stacks of photo albums, we can store virtually unlimited collection of pictures in the digital cloud. But in the cultural background to this digital shift, there's been a silent rebellion brewing. My guest tracks that rebellion in his book, The Revenge of the Analog. Today on the show, author David Sachs and I talk about why we're seeing a return to analog products like vinyl records, hard copy books, and pen and paper. And it's not just because of nostalgia. David goes into detail about the sudden revival of vinyl and turntables and why it's more than just a hipster fad, why hard copy book sales are going up while ebook sales are declining, and why writing with pen and paper unleashes creativity compared to typing or writing on a screen. He then gets into how the internet is counterintuitively driving this upsurge of interest in tangible products and the benefits we get psychologically, culturally, and economically by living in an analog world. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/analog. David Sachs, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Brett.
So you got a new book out. When I saw the title of it, I was really intrigued by the title. It's the Revenge of the Analog. And it's all about this trend you've been noticing where analog products, things like vinyl records, paperback books, stuff that we thought were going to be dead, are all of a sudden having this weird comeback. I'm curious, when did you notice that this stuff was, that we thought was dead because of the internet, because of digital technology? When did you start noticing it? When did you start noticing this trend of the revenge of the analog?
I guess it first kind of started appearing to me a decade ago. I was living in Toronto and, had just actually uploaded my entire CD collection to iTunes. And then, you know, my roommate and I had figured a way to stream it over the Wi-Fi. And it was like, that was it. We had reached peak digital music. And it was almost like our consumption of music disappeared overnight once that happened. And very shortly after that, ironically, his parents gave us their old turntable and their old records. And I started listening to records again and really getting into it. And I was noticing that, you know, a number of other people I knew who were also really into music were kind of getting back into turntables and records as well. And there were, you know, the music stores were still kind of, I guess, contracting at that point in the imagination, but the ones in our neighborhood were doing okay. And there was even like one or two new record stores that were opening up. There were new records, newly pressed records that were available. And I started noticing in other ways, you know, the Moleskine notebook had kind of become this ubiquitous thing by that point, where, you know, paperless technology, I mean, things like the Palm Pilot and the BlackBerry were supposed to have eradicated that. And it just kept getting sort of more deeply ingrained into the world I knew and the lives of people I knew. And so I think what interested me is, like, you know, it was this idea that, you know, you look around and you see things that aren't supposed to be happening in kind of the popular imagination, in the narrative that we're told about technological progress, which is, you know, the old thing is rendered obsolete by the new thing, and it disappears and goes away and everything moves forward and on. And it was almost like this was happening in a parallel way, right? It was, you know, the old thing had been rendered obsolete, and then it started growing again, even as the digital grew ever more, you know, quickly and more powerfully. And it was the beginning of something that I kept watching over the next couple of years, and it just kept getting bigger and having sort of more consequence to it. And especially, it was almost as though, you know, the greater and more powerful and more central to our lives the digital technology became, the more pervasive this revenge of analog, as I later called it, sort of grew into.
And I mean, so that brings my next question. Like, why? What do you think is driving this revenge of the analog? Is it people are just tired of digital technology? Like, they're tired of being able to stream whatever song they want at any place they are? Are they looking for, is it nostalgia? I mean, what's going on here? Why are people returning back to vinyl records and paper notebooks?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a number of different factors. It's not just one, and it certainly varies by individual. Nostalgia is kind of cited as the most common one, and I actually don't put a lot of weight in that. You know, most of this is being driven by people who are in their 30s or 20s or even younger that never touched or knew this technology in the first place. You know, my friend's daughter, who's 9 years old and asked for a Fujifilm Instax, you know, instant film camera last year for her birthday. I mean, this is a kid who's only known photography is something that happens on iPhones and iPads. The other notion that we're sort of tired of digital technology and rejecting it is also, I think, a false one. You know, most of us who are driving the return of analog things and ideas are as digitally enmeshed in the world as everyone around them, which is why when you go into a coffee shop and you see someone writing on a Moleskine notebook, they have their laptop and their, you know, phone next to them on the table. I think what that shows and what the reality is people are looking for a balance in what works for them, whether it's professionally and the way that they approach their work or their creative tasks, or whether it's personally, how they access culture and entertainment and leisure and the things in the world that matter to them. And the notion that we want, you know, we will be content with the most efficient thing and one solution, which is what, you know, the iPhone I'm holding in my hand now offers, right? You never need anything but this one thing, is one that I think we subscribe to. And now, having lived with that technology for 10 years, having seen something like, you know, digital music streaming services be around for a decade, we see that, okay, you can have that, but you also want more, right? It's almost the idea of, you know, once you've achieved all this, all the wealth and affluence or comfort in your life, it's not like you stop there. People are always saying, oh, when I make $1 million, you know, that I'm going to be set and that'll be it. And, you know, dust my hands off and bada bing, bada boom. But then you seek more. You seek more as a consumer. You seek more from a spiritual perspective, or you seek to find the things that work for you, even counterintuitively, right? Like the idea that, you know, something which is going to be the fastest and the best and the most powerful is always going to be accessed through a computer doesn't necessarily play out when you actually get down to using it. And so for many people, you know, digital has become almost an obstruction to the way they're doing things. And analog provides a bit of a counterweight to that and just a different process to create things, to enjoy things, to sort of, you know, interact with the world. And so I think it is almost a technological maturity that we're reaching, right? Where we're able to evaluate the strengths of each and say, well, you know, analog works for me here and digital works for me here, and I want both of them.
Yeah, and we'll talk about getting more specifics about how different analog things, like whether it's music or in books or whatever, the benefits of that you can't get with digital. But what I thought was an interesting argument you make throughout the book is that this revenge of the analog, in a lot of ways, is being powered by the internet, right? This thing that we thought was supposed to replace and sort of kill all this stuff. Like, the reason why it's making a comeback is because we have the internet and people are able to find, like, the Moleskine. I mean, the way I discovered the Moleskine was on the internet, you know, about 10 years ago when people were making Moleskine PDAs and showing how amazing Moleskines were for keeping track of your to-do list and whatever. And it's not just that, like other areas, the internet has brought back these old things.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, that's the interesting thing, and why it's not a technological rejection or, you know, a purely nostalgia-based thing, right? In many ways, you know, digital technologies, something like Kickstarter, for example, right? The crowdfunding website, as well as, you know, Indiegogo and others, have created, you know, tremendous opportunities for people to build analog products and services, things like, you know, board games and tabletop games, which previously, you know, the barrier to entry was fairly high. You needed to have a publisher, you needed to sell the rights, so on and so forth. Now someone can, you know, come up with an idea, make a quick little video, put it up there, and if it, you know, earns enough backing, then, you know, they're off to the races in production. The internet has allowed sort of disparate communities of niche users of products like you know, rare types of film photography, let's say, you know, expired Polaroid film or expired large format film, to find themselves from around the world and get in touch, share ideas, share projects that we're doing. And again, you know, build these markets, which can then scale at a pace when, you know, the regular large industry is sort of abandoned that at an early point. And then, of course, you even get into the things like, you know, manufacturing technologies, things like 3D printing or the ability to sort of source manufacturing around the world for specific ideas and products. Again, you know, all those who are driving this analog counter-revolution, if you want to call it that, are using every tool at their disposal to make it happen. They're not dogmatic about it, and, you know, sitting in some basement somewhere, you know, printing out mimeographed paper leaflets that they're handing out from soapboxes, unless that's their jam, you know, and more power to them for that.
Let's talk about some of the specific areas where you're seeing this revenge of the analog come back. Let's talk about vinyl first. Vinyl, I mean, just a few years ago, vinyl was pretty much dead. The press companies were shutting down. The ones that were open like two or three times a week. That was it. But like in the past, I don't know, 5 years, it's made this huge comeback. There's these companies where you can subscribe to get, you know, new vinyl records once a month. Turntable sales are just going nuts. Like for my birthday this year, my wife got me a turntable, and it's been fantastic. I mean, I think it's funny, in the book you mentioned like Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass. Like I got my dad's old Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass album, and it's fantastic. Can you give us an idea, what were vinyl sales like, say, 10 years ago, and what are they like now?
Well, the low point, you know, was in 2006. That's kind of the bottoming of sales. And the sales had been declining really since, you know, the early 80s when the compact disc came out. So you had sort of initial, you know, lowering when, you know, 8-tracks and tapes provided the first competition for vinyl records. And then, you know, I think 1986 or something is when CDs hit the mass market, and, you know, it just sort of steadily declined to there. And then, of course, downloading and so forth. So, you know, 2006 in the United States alone, you had, I think, 900 and something thousand new records pressed, right? None of this deals with, you know, secondhand vinyl. Your dad, my dad's Tijuana Brass, you know, Whipped Cream and Other Dreams, or whatever it's called, album, right? Every man of a certain generation has to own that. Just an example. So that's, you know, half, you know, less than a million records pressed. Last year, according to Nielsen, 2016, I think it was as high in the U.S. as maybe 13 million records pressed, new records, to say nothing of the trade of sort of secondhand records and other markets around the world, like the U.K. and Europe and South America, everywhere where vinyl has continued to grow. So you're talking about, you know, a 13 time or more growth in the span of a decade. And the growth has been fairly consistent, double-digit growth every single year. You know, every year there are skeptics saying, well, this is going to bottom out, this is going to crater, this isn't going to last, and every year it keeps growing. And of course, with that goes the sales of turntables, new turntables coming on the market by new companies or old companies reviving turntable designs. In order to service that growing demand, you know, because unlike digital music where you just copy and paste endlessly and it doesn't really matter, you know, you're talking about the physical production of a product, right? Melting pellets of plastic and sandwiching them in these giant waffle presses, which are, you know, record presses, which they don't make anymore. So not only do you have new record pressing companies opening up all around the United States and all around the world and in all these markets to serve them, you now have new companies building the record presses to service those. So not only are you talking about the growth of people buying records, the growth of people pressing records, the growth of record stores, of all sorts of different niches in cities and towns all over the world to serve this growing market, you're talking about all the jobs and the money and the economic activity that's going into that. And people now estimate it's $1 billion market, right, or more, which is incredible, because when I was interviewing someone, I think he was at either Warner Music or Universal Music, you know, 3 years ago when I was working on the book, he's like, I doubt this will ever be $1 billion market. jacket. That was his exact quote. And now, you know, it's there. So the growth has been pretty astounding. And I think if you live in any sizable community, anywhere, a town, a city, you can see it, right? You see people walking with record sleeves on the street. You see record stores opening up. You see people in Urban Outfitters shopping for a huge selection of records. Urban Outfitters is now the biggest, you know, retailer of records in the brick and mortar world. And it's, to many people, it's this undeniable example of the sort of larger phenomenon that that's happening. And to other people, they just can't wrap their heads around it. It's just kind of, you know, this back to the future moment that they can't square with the logic that, you know, in your phone, you can get all that music for free streamed to you wherever you are without having to put it on a shelf or deal with it or pay money for it.
So, I mean, what do you think's driving the comeback? I mean, like you said, it is, buying a record is inconvenient, right? If you go to the store, if you want to play something, you got to put it on the record player. When one side's over, you got to go and flip it over. So there is inconvenience. So, like, why are people going back to it if it is so inconvenient?
Well, let me ask you, why did you want a turntable for your birthday?
Part of the inconvenience was part of the thing that was surprisingly was the thing that drew me to it. I got sick of like streaming music devalued music to me, right? Cause like it's all became, it's sort of everything became Muzak, right? And I remembered having albums, like I had this thing I could heft in my hand. Like this is, I don't know, I like that feeling. And so that's why I got it.
Well, that is, you know, exactly the reason I think most people cite. And the key to it is that it is an entirely in a rational, emotional pursuit, right? From all logical perspectives, financial, you know, space saving, you know, time use, it makes the most logical sense to only listen to streamed music on, you know, some sort of Apple device or Android device, right? And that still holds true. But I think what we have to realize is like we are not logical creatures, right? We are highly illogical creatures. That's what allows us to make things like music, good music, bad music, whatever you have it. I mean, that is at the core of the human experience. And music is not something that, you know, is a necessity, is so much as, I mean, it's a necessity in some way, but it's not like food or medicine, right? Where we're, you know, seeking, you know, sustenance or something at the absolute most logical way. It is culture and it is passion and it is an emotional act. And while digital music allows us to access that in all sorts of different ways, it does so at the cost of many different points of engagement that we've realized, or many of us have realized, yourself and myself included, are actually very pleasurable, right? So, you know, going to a record store and flipping through bins for an hour to find one or two records you might like on a Saturday, you know, when you compare that with tapping on the search bar in Spotify or you know, the recommendation algorithm and pulling up something, is a highly inefficient act. It's, you know, a waste of your time. It requires you to go somewhere in your car or on your foot. It costs a lot more money. And yet it's so much fun, right? Buying a record at the store is almost half the fun of buying a record. You talk to people, you discover things, you make friendships, you are spending time doing something that isn't just sitting at home looking at the same screen you look at all day. In the same way that having that collection displayed in your house, even though it takes up precious shelf space and it's heavy as hell, and when you have to move, good Lord, you know, get a chiropractor because those boxes of records are some of the heaviest damn things you'll ever have to move. There's a pleasure in that too. You walk in and see the records on the shelf and it's like, you know, that is the lion head on your wall if you're a record collector. It is your personal taste there for everyone to see in a way that's very different and much more personal and much more permanent than, you know, a curated playlist that you might, you know, share socially on a site like Spotify or Apple Music or whatever the, you know, whatever thing you subscribe to for, you know, $8 a month. And I think that's, that, you know, shows the sort of deeper relationship we have as humans have to the physical world and real things, right? They give us a way to interact with the world, with our five senses, and most importantly, with each other, that the digital world simply doesn't. It renders those things obsolete because of the nature of the efficiency in the communication.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea, like the tangible, actually socializing more visceral as well, right? Because like, yeah, you can go over to someone's house, you can flip through their albums or look through their bookshelves, and like you can take something out and you can, you have this conversation that's awesome. Then you can share your whole book collection or your whole CD collection or your music collection to your friend, but it's not the same. Like you won't have that conversation, that same sort of conversation as you would if you were in person holding this object.
Right. Could you, I mean, you wouldn't, you know, strike up, you could very easily be walking down the street or in a coffee shop or on an airplane or somewhere, and someone could have a book with them, right? And you can immediately start a conversation based upon a shared interest in that book. But the nature of, you know, digital technology is that there is an element of privacy, a sort of cocoon around it. You're never going to look on someone's screen and say, oh, you're reading that on your Kindle? Oh, cool, I read The Revenge of Analog. It renders it kind of faceless. And so, in many ways, I mean, and there's sociologists that talk about this, you know, these devices that were sort of there to create greater social interactions and experience have in many ways sort of created a barrier to them. We can have these surface interactions and experiences on, you know, Twitter and Facebook, but, you know, the deeper face-to-face interactions, that which we need as human beings in order to thrive and survive in the world, analog still remains the best outlet for that to happen.
I also like, one of the other things I like about analog products is you can lend it out to people. Right. There's like things you can somehow share but like I love being able to borrow a book from somebody or borrow an album, or if you're, you know, kid from the 80s, like borrow video games, right? I mean, that was just, it was fun. I don't know what it was. And then whenever you see that object in your house, like not only do you think about the content in the object, but you also think about the person who owns that object. Like, oh yeah, this was Ben, this is like a part of Ben that I have in my house. And then it makes you, I should reach out to Ben and talk about what I read in his book.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said, your wife gave you the turntable for your birthday, right? I mean, that is, every time you look at that turntable, you're going to think of her. My turntable was given to me by my friend, Dave Levy, who's a musician and a DJ, and, you know, works in human rights around the world. And it, for my 30th birthday in New York, he had an extra turntable and he's like, here you go, man. Here you go. And I, you know, every time I put it on, I think about him. And every year for his birthday, when he comes back to Toronto, I buy him a record as a thank you. I mean, that is the basis of a relationship, right? You can't do that in the same way with digital music. You know, someone bought me a subscription to a streaming service once. Yeah, it was cool. You know, and then the next year I had to pay for the subscription myself. You know, how many times have you been emailed some sort of Amazon gift card and you're like, okay, cool. It doesn't, again, hold that same meaning. It doesn't hold that same value. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that really struck me is, you know, the reasons that you talked about why you wanted a turntable, why you enjoy it. And the reasons that are cited by many people, especially of, you know, a younger generation, sound is like the bottom one, right? There's this assumption by, you know, baby boomers and those older that, oh, this is a new generation of audiophiles and the sound quality is better. But sound quality is highly subjective. I have a lot of sort of old scratchy records that the sound quality isn't necessarily great. And if I listen to that same file on a streaming service, it might actually sound better. But the sound is just one element of the experience. And music, like so many other things in our life, is actually more than just the way the information is purely translated. It is an experience that we indulge in with all our five senses. And I think that's something that we took for granted for a number of years as we moved to digitize things, you know, as quickly as possible.
All right, let's shift gears to books, because I remember a few years ago, a week wouldn't go by when you didn't, you know, read some article about the death of publishing, right? That the e-reader was going to kill paperback, hardbound books. But that didn't happen. In fact, I think I read a recent study that said that e-readers, like e-books, are going down while paperback books and hard copy books are going up. So what's going on there? Why are people returning to dead tree books instead of using the convenience of a Kindle reader or something?
Well, I think they never even went away. That was the interesting thing, that there were these predictions that when the Kindle came out in, I think, 2007 or so, this would be it, right? This would be, you know, the MP3 moment for the publishing industry, and all the publishers were sort of quaking in their boots. And it never really happened. Ebooks have certainly grown. They own a percentage of the market. You know, Kindles and e-readers and Kobos and so on, you know, have a percentage too, though that percentage is declining. And their decline is a mix of people's kind of not using them as much. Like, I haven't touched my Kindle in a year and a half or 2 years, as well as, you know, competition from other devices where you can just get the Kindle app on your iPad and you don't even need to buy the dedicated device. But I think what, you know, the most important thing was, is that people, especially in the digital media industry, as well as the publishing industry, they really discounted the value that people place on books as objects. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about records, right? It is an illogical thing. Even more so, information, if you buy, you know, a copy of The Revenge of Analog on Kindle or Kobo or Nook or whatever, you're going to pay less money for it. And the information is the exact same. You don't get any extra words, right? You don't get any fewer words either. When you go out and pay, you know, $26 or whatever it is for the hardcover version of that book, you're getting a chunk of dead tree with some letters printed on it, and it's the exact same as the other one. You know, I just got recently like some statistics from my publisher about how the book's doing. You know, take a guess at what percentage of The Revenge of Analog was sold in digital.
I'm going to say 25%.
I think it's like 8%, which is fairly standard for, you know, most, you know, mass market books out there. There's certain areas, romance, fantasy, self-published, where ebooks are certainly statistically much higher. But, you know, your average sort of nonfiction book that might be on the bestseller list or fiction book is, you know, a relatively small percentage, which represents the percentage of sales, you know, for the publishing industry overall of what those books represent. So why is it? Why is it that people will still go out and pay for these, you know, stacks of dead shredded trees with ink on them? What is it about it? It's, again, the relationship we have to books, right? What they represent, what they symbolize. They are aspirational capitalism at its finest. We have a very strong emotional attachment to them. The idea of having a bookcase filled with books in your house is, you know, that is it. You have arrived as a member of the, you know, educated middle class. And I think it goes back to childhood. I have two very young kids, you know, a 3.5-year-old who's a voracious little reader, with me reading to her, of course, and you know, a 7-month-old. And, you know, books are their life. Books are everything, especially to the older one. I mean, you know, a night without 3 stories or 4 stories with a whole lot of begging in it, there's no bedtime. I mean, it wouldn't happen. So it's such an ingrained part of the way we live and see the world, but it's also something that, again, has those same tactile advantages. You can loan a friend a book, you can mark them up, you never have to worry about the battery failing. They can last for hundreds and hundreds of years. You can give them as gifts, you can give them away, you can do whatever you want to them, and they remain there. It is very much the sort of perfect form for how we love to absorb information. And so they prove resilient. And I think, you know, very little is going to come and change that, simply because it's proven to be something that we actually want and desire.
Right. I think I read also another study that that came out not too long ago, that people actually retain information better when they read from a printed page compared to from when they read on a screen. It's something about the tangibility of the thing that helps, supposedly. But I've noticed that myself. When I read on a screen, I just tend to skim. But when I read a book, like a physical book, I'm more absorbed in the process.
Yeah, and you know, listen, I used my Kindle almost exclusively for a year or two and read some fantastic books on it. And it didn't diminish those books in any way. But, you know, what was interesting was when I began research on this book, I got a library card. You know, Toronto Public Library. And I started out taking out books for research that I didn't necessarily want to own. I just needed to read, you know, a little bit of, take some notes and send them back. And so I remember reading the first book and paper that I read, you know, after a year and a half of using the Kindle. And it was just instantly, like, within two pages, I was like, oh yeah, I like reading this way so much more. That was it. There was no overt reason why. I mean, one of the things was knowing where a page is and knowing where you are just by sort of sense and feel, right? Instead of having the little numerical, oh, you're, you know, 10% done, or you're on page 106 of, you know, 252, you could feel it, you could flip, you could skim back. You didn't have to deal with menus and options. It's the simplicity of an act that we've known, again, since, you know, we were young children. I watch my three, you know, my 7-month-old, you know, now he knows how to flip back and forth in his little, you know, 5-page Sandra Boynton picture books. You know, he'll grab the page and flip it back and then put it in his mouth and vomit on it. But, you know, there is something, again, inherently hardwired into our brains about that. And that's because we are tactile creatures, right? We like to touch. We have our 5 senses and we like to use them. And the more we use them, the more we get out of something, which is why, you know, the digital world, which limits us to sort of taps with a fingertip on a flat, textureless piece of glass, doesn't give us that same sensory feedback.
Yeah, you just brought up another reason I just remembered why I am sort of returning to paperback books and music. This is going to sound really tinfoil hatty, but like when you buy like an ebook or digital music, like you read the terms of service, like you really don't own it. Right? Like you're sort of renting it from Amazon or whatever. And like they could take that back. They could delete it right from your device. And you couldn't really do, you don't have much recourse going on. And so like, but when you have like an actual object, like Amazon can't come into your house and steal it because like there's laws that can say, no, you can't do that. So that's another reason. Like I like knowing that I own my culture. Like this is mine. You can't take it back or delete it accidentally or whatever.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, it's too crazy what you're talking about. I mean, before I had a subscription to Spotify, I had a subscription to Ardeo, which was a competitor. It raised, you know, $200 million. And I had, you know, I liked it better than Spotify, and I had all sorts of albums saved and playlists that I'd made because I listen to digital music when I'm, you know, in the car or walking, when I can't lug my turntable around with me. And then it went bankrupt. And it was like, they sent a little thing. It's like, hey, you know, we're really sorry. We've gone bankrupt, or we've been bought by Pandora and we're going to be absorbed into their company. As of Monday, your service will be done. And that was it. It was like, poof, everything was gone, right? All the albums I'd saved, all the things I'd done was gone. But, you know, unless someone breaks into my house or there's a fire or a flood, my records will be there. And they are to do with whatever I want to do with them. If I want to give them away, if I want to sell them, if I want to store them, if I want to crack them over my knee, I can do whatever I want with them. It's my property. I think they're, you know, this notion that we would move beyond an ownership society is one of these fantastical ideas that gets bandied about in kind of, you know, Silicon Valley utopian circles, that goes against human nature and what we like about the world and how we want to interact with the world.
So let's move back onto paper, right? So that's another thing. Like I remember my uncle said this a while back, and this was like 2 decades ago, that it's like, yeah, you know, they've been saying we're gonna have a paperless office, but like there's more paper than ever. Like I feel like I have more paper, and that's gotten true. Like even with these new devices that have made, you know, given the possibility of paper becoming obsolete, we are still drawn to paper. And in the book, you talk about, you know, the Moleskine notebook, but there's other things out there like Field Notes that are really popular with people. What's the obsession there? Why are we so drawn to tactile writing technology, like just the old-fashioned pen and notebook?
Because it works, right? if you want to have an idea that pops into your head and there's a pen and a paper sitting there on the desk next to you and there's, you know, a laptop or a smartphone, what is the quickest, easiest way to get that idea down without any distractions? It's the pen and the paper, right? It is instantaneous and you're not restrained by what the software commands you to do. If I wanted to take a note on a computer, I have to go open up a program, figure out where to save that file, save the file, figure out the format that I want to write it in, and I can only write what it will allow me. I can't doodle in some way. I can't fold it over. I can't scribble things out, which is why, you know, at the biggest, most successful tech companies, whether it's Amazon or Google or Facebook, you know, on the desks of the brilliant engineers and creatives that work there, you have, you know, people using Moleskine notebooks or Field notebooks or just good old pieces of scrap paper or whiteboards, because again, it is the shortest way for an idea to leave your brain and enter the physical world in some sense of permanence. And I think it's incredibly useful to have that balance, right? So yeah, there's the idea of, you know, having to format it and all that and all those simplistic things. But again, it gives you the opportunity to do things in a way that's entirely unique to you. Whereas if I'm typing a note on my computer, you know, it's formatted in the same way that, you know, Microsoft Word tells all documents to be formatted. Or the amount of work that I have to go into to make it unique is, you know, a step away from just getting that idea out there. It doesn't mean that everybody is going to move back to, you know, writing things on paper and then banging out ideas on typewriters. There is a point where moving back to the digital provides so many advantages and it's just better. I didn't write this book on a typewriter. I wrote it on a computer. I'm a much faster typer than I am with handwriting, and my handwriting is atrocious and barely legible. But it allows me to think in a way almost out loud that I can't do in the same way on a computer when I'm typing. And so it proves very useful to people because it's a siloed act. When you're writing something in a notebook or a piece of paper or on a whiteboard, you're just writing something, right? You're not trying to do 10 other things at once. You're not being distracted by multiple tasks coming in. You're not trying to merge it with images and video like a PowerPoint presentation, which are the worst things in the world. You are, you know, there with the simplicity of your idea and working through it in a way that allows it to be seen, but also very quickly changed and edited, that doesn't feel precious, that just works. And I think that's it. I think at the end of the day, you know, beyond the romantic notions of, you know, Hemingway and Picasso using the notebook to create like Moleskine uses, or, you know, the great American field notebook of, you know, great American workers like Field Notes uses, or whatever it happens to be, you know, it just works for people, right? It just works for people.
Yeah. I was actually talking to an architect friend of mine about this topic. He's been in the field for over 30 years. So before CAD really took on, and he mentioned that one of the saddest things that's happened in architecture in the past, you know, 20 or so years is that this over-reliance on computer programs to design architecture. Because before, you, an architect, would just take out some paper, a blue, and just like draw, like freehand draw with the ruler. And he said, you get these beautiful designs that would just look aesthetically pleasing, but were also architecturally sound. He says, now people just go to the computer. It's fast because there's these pre-programmed things that, you know, they'll tell you, you draw a line, it'll tell me how many studs you need, everything's done, but like it limits creativity. And he says like our architecture has suffered as a result of that.
Yeah, there's interesting studies around that, around architecture and design. You know, one of the reasons why I interviewed someone named John Skidjo, who works at Google. He's one of their sort of chief designers of user experience and user interface. So how all Google products, websites, Gmail, whatever, how they look and how they work. And he created this course for teaching other designers and employees at Google how to draw things by hand on paper. And it since became mandatory pretty much for everybody at Google who works on these types of products. And he explained to me why. He said, because, you know, the software creates a bias, right? It will always steer you in the direction of what it wants you to do or what's going to be easiest or most standardized. And that's because the nature of software is to standardize things. You create one set of software and it has a set of rules, and those rules go out to every edition of that software. And you can move, but you have to move within the bounds of the rules, right? On paper, you really only have to move within the bounds, the physical bounds of the page, but you can do whatever the hell you want there. And so with Google, you know, and many ad firms and now, you know, some architecture firms, the idea is when you are working on an idea for something at the first stage, let's say designing a building, right? Don't go to the computer first. Go to paper first. Get your idea out, scribble it, squiggle it. Doesn't have to be perfect. Imperfection is actually the goal. And then once you have it down of what you want and what you're working, then transfer it into the computer, then scan it, then, you know, rework it, and then work on the fine details and figure out how many studs you need and what type of steel and what angle that has to be at, so the thing doesn't collapse on your head. And I think it is, you know, fundamentally what we're talking about here is re-embracing a kind of imperfection in the world, right? And saying, look, we have built these wonderful one-size-all-fits solutions for every sort of aspect of our life, but we don't live in a one-size-all-fits world. And it's actually not advantageous to us all the time.
Let's talk about, you wrote an article for Esquire magazine not too long ago. I remember this article. It was near the front of the magazine. That's why I remembered it. And I think that's where I found out about your book, this book that we're talking about right now, about men and collecting stuff. Because we've written about collecting stuff on the site before as like this hobby and like stuff guys collect. And guys love to talk about their collections. But this digital world makes it harder and harder to collect stuff because you don't have albums to collect, you don't have books to collect, so you're kind of left collecting other stuff. Why do you think it's so important for guys to have a collection? And why do you think men, and I think women might have this draw, but I think men have this draw. I know I like stuff more than my wife. I like to collect weird knickknacks. What is it about stuff and collecting things in men?
I think it really is, you know, very primal, right? We are, you know, the hunters, and we want our conquests there on the wall. I'm sitting here in my home office. You know, I have, you know, an award one of my books won and some article about another one of my books and, you know, the poster for the launch party of this book. They're up there. I have, you know, stacks of different books that I bought, which I've probably read once and will never read again. And I resist every time my wife's like, KonMari, we have to clean out the house. We have to clean this out. Too much stuff. I'm like, no, don't touch it. Don't touch that book. I have an emotional attachment to it. I want to see that. I just want to know it's there. It's an inexplicable thing, but it gives us a sense of grounding, right? You know, we live in a world where increasingly the pace of change is so fast and uncertainty is the norm, whether we're talking about economic uncertainty, technological uncertainty, or, you know, political uncertainty. And we need things to sort of ground ourselves to and anchor ourselves to. And so there's comfort in that, right? There is comfort in, you know, again, when you're feeling anxious, you know, going to that record collection on your shelf and just rubbing your fingers along the spine and picking out something that resonates with you, whether it's at a breakup or a time of, you know, economic or familial uncertainty in your life. These items are, you know, more than just kind of the lion heads on our wall. They're security blankets in some ways. They're what grounds us to the past, right? Oh, this album is, you know, I remember getting this album on my first date, or, you know, when I graduated college or whatever. And that, I think, makes us more human. I think the idea that, you know, we as men must always be moving forward and moving on and, you know, smashing the past and disrupting, it doesn't leave us with much to hold on to. We need to be rooted in some sort of sense of personal identity, and sometimes that rooting happens with physical things. And so it's, you know, collecting it, whether it's a collection of beer cans or of like stupid t-shirts. My brother, remember those big Johnson t-shirts? My brother had, like, at one point he had like 10 of them. I don't know, you know, it's like every time we went on vacation, he had, I mean, you know, sports memorabilia. Like there was no reason to own, you know, Michael Jordan shoe for $2,000. But I know people who do because it gives them some sense of who they are that they can look at and be like, this is my value, right? This is what I like.
David Sacks, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. My guest today was David Sacks. His book is Revenge of the Analog. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Try picking it up in a hard copy book instead of a digital one. Go along with the theme of the podcast. Make sure to check out our show notes at aom.is/analog, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. As always, appreciate your continued support. If you can give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, that helps us out a lot. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.